This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Most little kids notice everything, but just because they notice doesn't mean they put the same meaning to them as older people. Imagine babies of different races playing together. Can they even understand the concept of race? By the time they get to elementary school, though, they probably picked up how we adults see the world. As part of this month's series on race, we're going to look at race consciousness in kids. For some background, we have Krista Brown, assistant professor in psychology at the University of Kentucky. Welcome, Krista.
Hi, how are you?
So you study the perceptions of race in children. So when do children start to perceive that there is this thing, race, let alone what it really means to most adults?
Well, I mean, it's noticing the differences versus knowing what the differences really mean. So research with babies shows that kids notice racial differences very, very early, by a year or so. By preschool, they start to talk about racial groups a lot more frequently, but it's really a focus on kind of skin color and noticing that we all come in different shades. But about preschool, about 3 to 5 years old, kids start labeling themselves often with racial terms. So using like black and white, which don't actually reflect the actual color, so it shows that they're actually understanding that these categories have labels that have social meaning.
Is there a difference between how kids start to make these assessments and understand what other people are versus what they are? Do kids, or I guess what I'm saying is, would a kid say, I'm black or I'm white before they would say someone else is like, oh, he's black, he's white, or is it all part of the same continuum?
No, they actually start to notice it in other people before they kind of recognize it in themselves. And they also start to recognize things like stereotypes and kind of attributes that go along with our social groups and others before they realize that those attributes might be applied to themselves. So it's a while before that kind of self-knowledge comes up to the same level as other knowledge.
What about the nature versus nurture issue? Is separating people into races something that human beings were just built to do biologically or in an evolutionary sense? Or is this all culture and how we've developed it?
Now most of us think that they're really pretty socially constructed groups because they're really arbitrary what the kind of boundaries for racial groups are. They change. We really socially define them. And it doesn't seem as though kids naturally necessarily stereotype and put much importance on race. It's just that they notice that adults seem to use these groups in some kind of meaningful way. And so kids seem to look to the cues that adults are putting in place before they recognize that this is an important group, I better pay attention to it. So I would argue that this really is a very much a nurture kind of argument that because we treat the groups as meaningful, kids learn that these groups must be meaningful in some way.
So then I presume that how people view race, how kids view race, whether it is something that just exists or whether it's something that has implications like don't talk to this person, don't be
right
around this person, the kind of weight that you put on race is something that's learned.
Yes, and so that's what happens. So you see preschoolers noticing that we come in different shades, and they notice it quite a bit because it is a really salient physical difference. But they really don't start learning the kind of rules that go along with how we treat members of racial groups really until about elementary school. And about 7 or 8 is when you really start to see them becoming aware of kind of social status differences, and stereotypes, and then that's going to affect their later perceptions. But that comes much later than just noticing that we're groups.
How about this? Can you socially engineer, if you're a parent who, mm-hmm. say, you know, wants your kids to be perfectly racially harmonious with everyone,
right,
can you socially engineer that if no one else has bought into your construct, if other people still have their baggage? I mean, we all do, but let's say theoretically there was someone who had absolutely no prejudice, but they're living in the real world. Could you raise kids that don't take on any of the issues of prejudice and stereotyping just by parenting?
You have to be really active at it. I think that kids, for one, are very aware of the broader society we live in. So kids are really aware of media messages. They're really aware of what they see when they go into stores and restaurants. So parents are by no means the only socializing agents. So parents have to be really active against all those other messages kids are getting. So one train of thought is that what parents should do then to counteract all of that, because we know that raising kids to be colorblind doesn't work because society's not colorblind, and so we have to give kids other explanations for why there's things like segregation and why there's negative stereotypic portrayals of African Americans, for example, on TV and movies.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to for parents to actively combat that is to give kids basically kind of a racism label so that they can recognize when they see negative stereotypes to label it as a stereotype.
Okay.
And so that they could, so that, because kids kind of construct their own meaning for what they see in the world. So for
Professor, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
We were speaking to Professor Christia Brown. She is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Kentucky. And we've got some personal stories about how race impacts kids' lives. First, we've got Marty Guzman, a mother of two biracial children who were raised in many places across the country, including Anchorage, Alaska, where she lives now. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
So you're Black, your husband is Puerto Rican, he's in the military. You guys have been in a lot of places where there's not a lot of folks of perhaps your color.
Yes.
Wyoming, North Dakota, Alaska.
Germany, yep.
Yeah. So your kids are in their 20s now, but growing up, how did they come to realize that maybe they were different in some ways from some of their classmates and friends?
Well, exactly. They did grow up primarily in North Dakota and Germany for those years that the professor was talking about, when they did first go to school and kind of leave the nest and realize people are different. And so, you know, I actually had to call him last night and you know, she had talked about colorblind. I think I raised my children to be colorblind, but with an open mind, you know, that there are going to be other people that think other ways, but this is the way we think. And one instance was second grade, and my daughter, she knew she was half Black and half Puerto Rican, and she knew she was different than, you know, a lot of her white classmates, but they didn't have a crayon that was her color. You know, she didn't match the brown crayon. She didn't match the white crayon. And so she told me she was peach, and she just decided she was peach for a while. And we thought, okay. You know, we just said, well, it does match your skin. We took it out of the crayon box. We compared it to her arm. And, you know, it was just like the sweetest thing. We just told her, okay, you can be peach.
Well, do you think that do you think it was a burden on your kids in any way to have to deal with other people's perceptions of them?
Absolutely not. You know, my husband's really quiet, but I'm very outgoing, and I have one of each. My daughter's very outgoing like me, and my son's quiet. And people are just naturally drawn to them, first because they didn't look like everybody else, and then second, because they knew that they might have something different to share. We've had quite a few of their friends that came over to the house and had rice and beans for the first time. You know, they'd never known a Hispanic family well enough to be invited in and to share that meal that's really an important part of being, you know, Puerto Rican, rice and beans. And the kids knew that was a big part of their life, but then, you know, mom's Black. She's got her things that are customs and traditions. So I think they really just kind of like had no problems at all being biracial.
You're working at a elementary school right now,
mm-hmm.
with kids, and do you think that people have learned anything in the past 20 years about what it takes from a classroom perspective to make sure that kids are dealing respectfully with race?
Oh, definitely. We educate our staff. I'm the family resource coordinator, and we talk at length about our minority populations. My school is it's a Title I school, so, you know, our population is at or below poverty level, and I believe we're at 87% minority here at this school, and the recent figures came out that our staff is 17% minority. So new teachers or, you know, teachers that aren't familiar with minority customs and ideals, we have some actual books and workshops and things that we try and put into place so that they can understand where that child is coming from. It's not that world that they grew up in. they have a whole different set of social norms that they're bringing to school with them.
Do you think in the end that you were able to be the leading driver of how your kids think about race, or do you think that the outside world, whether it was television or kids at school?
Oh, most definitely the home. I mean, my mom growing up used to take greeting cards and color in the white people on a greeting card and put a little afro, and I did that for my children too. They just didn't have greeting cards that showed our family. They said, you know, I love you, mommy, or they love you, grandma, but the grandma or the mommy was not our grandma or mommy. So, you know, it's like if you don't have it, bring it, and if you don't, you know, have it, make it. You know, just let them know that they are different and they're loved. You know, it's not, you know, it's like kind of like not rocket science, but you cannot kind of overthink it too much.
Well, Marty, thanks. Great practical advice as well as everything else. Thank you.
You're very, very, very welcome. Thank you.
We were talking to Marty Guzman. She and her family live in Anchorage, Alaska, where she works at Russian Jack Elementary School. And in some ways, Sarah Catania had the flip side of the experience that the Guzman children are having. She was one of the only white kids in an all-black school on the south side of Chicago. Today, she's an independent journalist and a journalism teacher at the University of Southern California. It's great to see you.
You too, Farai. Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, so this is your secret racial history. It's not secret, but, you know, I know you, and I didn't even know until I read your article that you had grown up in a neighborhood where you were one of the, you know, there's this phrase, the raisin in the bun. So you were the white chocolate chip cookie and white chocolate chip and the chocolate chip cookie.
Exactly.
What was it like?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, I did a long article for Mother Jones Magazine a couple of years ago on my experiences growing up as one of the only white kids in my neighborhood and in my school on the south side of Chicago. And then after Barack Obama was elected, I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post about my confusion and my sort of sadness in the wake of his election, which I was sort of trying to understand why I felt that way. And it all goes back to my, you know, to that experience as a child. It was definitely a growing up experience of its moment historically. My parents moved their very young family, I was just a baby, to a neighborhood that was a social experiment. It was a neighborhood that was an intentional community built and designed to bring black and white people together on the south side of Chicago. And this was, you know, King was assassinated when I was a old. This was in the wake of his assassination. This was in the wake of and during ongoing racial strife in Chicago, one of the most racially stratified cities in America still, unfortunately. So my parents moved us to this neighborhood, and with all good intentions, you know, let's turn this whole paradigm on its head, this whole paradigm about the white flight from the black communities. Why don't we instead move into a traditionally black community and show we are not afraid? We're middle-class white people, and we can do this. We can do this. But, of course, it wasn't that easy.
You had, among other things, a kind of period where you were cut off from the herd.
Yeah,
as a child.
Now, let me just tell you about the racial awakening for me. Dr. Brown was talking about, how children at a very early age become aware of their race or their color. And I think that's true because I was thinking about, well, when did I realize that I was white? And I can't remember ever not knowing it. It's kind of like gender. You know, do you know the moment that you knew you were a girl? Probably not. So I always knew that I was white. And color was such a defining part of our experience as children that it was always present. And it was present in the larger culture as well. Those social cues were all there at that time. But what was really significant for me was having my peers recognize my color, because I didn't want them to know that I was white. I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to stand out. I didn't want to draw attention to myself in any way. I wanted to be like everyone else. And so that worked for a while. I think because I was the only white kid in my class, it didn't really occur to anybody to think about the fact that I might be different. As we all know, there is no such thing as one shade of black. And in my school, black kids came in every shade of skin color. Some kids had whiter skin than I did. So somehow it just didn't come up until second grade. And again, Dr. Brown talked about that sort of socialization process and when kids start really becoming conscious of that. And that's when I was confronted by a group of my peers about being white. And I was really, I was rejected by the group as a result of them sort of stating it was what I think people probably sort of were aware of, but hadn't been articulated. Once that became articulated as a true fact, you are white, therefore you are not one of us, I was rejected by the group.
We only have like a minute left, but you know what? We're going to have you back on to talk more about this. But as a mother now, of two young children, what did you learn from what sounds like an incredibly wrenching experience that you've passed on to your kids, either in terms of how you're raising them or how you feel you want to protect them?
I'm still trying to figure it out, but just let me share with you, and I wrote about this a little bit in this piece I wrote on Huffington Post, my children's reaction to Barack Obama's election. You know, while I was very much torn up by it, my son was nothing but absolutely enthusiastic and excited. Took my I voted sticker, put it on, made his own American flag. He could not be happier. So I feel like, you know, positive change is happening.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Fry.
Sarah Catania is an independent journalist who also teaches at the University of Southern California. She joined us here at the studios of NPR West. And next on News and Notes, hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons tells us about his social networking venture, and Mario Armstrong sizes up the Obama tech agenda. You're listening to News and Notes from NPR News.